Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, May 21st, 2013. We open and close the podcast today.
Strange days have found us.
With the keyboard stylings of Ray Manzarek.
Strange days have tracked us down.
Founding member of The Doors, and a man who went on to entertain us in many different ways. Including using his powerful voice for spoken word delivery. Ray Manzarek died in Germany after a battle with cancer yesterday at the age of 74. And yes, these are strange days. And on Capitol Hill today, Tim Cook, the guy who took over the reins of Apple Computer when Steve Jobs died, was there defending his company from the incredible array of tax dodges that it employs. And while members of the Senate subcommittee who heard his testimony aren't willing to say that this is illegal, or even that it's wrong, I am. And Tim Cook went out of his way. He repeatedly stated in a prepared statement that he delivered to the committee, "We're an American company." Well, Apple doesn't act like an American company. All of its manufacturing is currently offshore, most of it in China, at substandard wages and working conditions. And Foxconn, the Apple subcontractor, is allowing a Chinese version of a labor union to be instituted at many of its factories that produce Apple products. That is a great leap forward, not available to Apple employees in the United States, where its workforce is entirely non-union. Now, Apple workers would say, we don't need a union because we get free iPods and discounts on iPads, and they pay us pretty well. My issue is that Apple doesn't pay its fair share in taxes. That's not how Tim Cook spun it up. He said, the way I look at this is that Apple pays 30.5% of its profits in taxes in the United States. Both of his fingers were crossed and stuck up his butt. I couldn't resist. I'm sorry. I mean, that is so bogus. Because the testimony of experts and academics before the committee shows that, for example, between 2009 and 2012, some $30 billion of the company's net income was reported to entities that are stateless, that have no employees. They're just fictional entities that, quote, have no declared tax residency anywhere in the world and as a consequence paid no corporate income tax to any national government on that stream of money for the past 5 years. How about another Apple subsidiary, Apple Sales International? It claims no tax residency anywhere, despite sales income of $74 billion from 09 to 12. That subsidiary, zero employees and no physical presence. That's as virtual as you can get. They're sitting on $145 billion in cash. About $100 billion of that is retained foreign earnings. It's offshore. They're waiting for Barbara Boxer to give them the next Silicon Valley tax holiday. Last time she did it in 2004, she claimed that it was going to produce jobs in the United States. Well, it made Steve Jobs a wealthier man. Apple eventually started to pay dividends. But there was no appreciable indication at Apple or any other American company that the tax holiday produced new jobs for Americans in the United States. Then there's the Irish twist. They've got a sweetheart deal where they pay only a 2% tax rate in Ireland, while the stipulated rate there is 12% for corporations, and the nominal rate in the United States is 35%. And Apple is not alone. But I single them out for abuse because I use their products more than I use ExxonMobil's gasoline, for example. and I would like to see the company that I contribute to revenues and in turn profits. When I buy an iTunes song and that sale is recorded in Belgium? Well, Tim Cook maintains that their archives are offshore and therefore that's where the business took place. But I bought the song here in California. And these dodges cannot continue forever. If Apple truly is an American company, they should prove it and step up and pay their frickin' taxes. They trotted out J. Richard Harvey Jr., professor at Villanova's law school. He estimated that Apple's legal maneuvering saved the company $7.7 billion in American taxes in 2011 alone. In the same year, 64% of Apple's global pre-tax income was recorded in Ireland, where only 4% of its employees and 1% of its customers were located. And when Professor Harvey heard that Apple doesn't use tax gimmicks, he said, "Well, when I heard that, I about fell off my chair." By the way, yesterday when I was speaking to you here in my News and Comment podcast, I used my Foxconn 5 iPhone, and I asked Siri, the voice of Apple, if Apple uses tax gimmicks. And she was programmed to respond, "Would you like me to look up Apple uses tax gimmicks on the internet?" It's been 24 hours, and Siri has yet to get back to me. Another corporate bigwig survived an effort to take away one of his jobs. The man who Reverend Billy refers to as the devil in corporate America, Jamie Dimon, repelled another shareholder effort to make him choose to be either chair or CEO, but not both, of J.P. Morgan Chase. A similar measure last year drew 40% of shareholder votes. This year it was only 32.2%. And that's even after, what was it, $6 billion worth of losses by the trader known as the Whale in London? That's pretty surprising. The devil gets to keep both of his gigs. Meanwhile, in Washington, one thing I've been preparing for has occurred in the IRS scandal. One of the officials of the IRS is planning to take the Fifth. It's never a good sign when witnesses before a congressional committee lawyer up and say, "Congressman, Senator, I'd love to answer that question, but this lawyer here told me to tell you that I have a Fifth Amendment right not to do so." And the person in question here is Lois Lerner, the IRS official who was running the office in Cincinnati. And as you may know, your humble host grew up in Cincinnati. And there are two big reasons I left. The humidity is unbearable at many points across the summer. And it's a Republican machine town, and I could not live there. And I point this out because I don't know any of the individual employees at the IRS unit in Cincinnati, including Lois Lerner. But I know the tenor of Cincinnati. They love Tea Party Republicans. John Boehner is from Cincinnati. And there are many other Neanderthal Republicans, Rob Portman. And who's that? There's a woman who got knocked off, Congresswoman. Oh, boy, I can't remember her name, but she was just as mean as they came. Mean Jean Schmidt served, I think, 3 terms and then was knocked off by a distant cousin of mine who is even worse than she is. He's a Tea Party nut named Dan Wenstrup, first-termer in Congress right now. So I find it hard to believe that the worker bees in Cincinnati had a political bias against the Tea Party groups that applied for phony nonprofit status. That's what this unit of the IRS does. In addition to Lois Lerner's announcement that she's going to take the Fifth, the Associated Press reports today that White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough and other senior advisors knew in late April about this IRS report, the targeting of conservative groups, And they're trying to spin up the knowledge of top aides, but the ignorance of the president, as a good thing. They're trying to tell us, well, there's an independent investigation. The history of White House interference with the IRS means that it should all be at arm's length. And so, yes, we knew about this, but we chose not to tell the president. You believe that? I'm sure we're going to find out. The Republicans smell blood in the water, and they will keep chumming until they can get their shark's teeth into Obama's skinny little butt. Very interesting move by Alan Grayson, the fiery Democratic congressman who is back in the House from Florida after sitting out a term. And he's raised a very interesting challenge to Speaker John Boehner. Because before the House right now is a bill called H.R. 3, the Northern Route Approval Act. And it purports to be a decision by Congress to move forward on the Keystone XL pipeline on the northern branch of that. And under a special kind of arcane rule of the House, Congressman Grayson is saying that as a matter of privilege, affecting the right of the House collectively, its safety, its dignity, and the integrity of its proceedings, he is calling on the Speaker to allow a vote on his issue within 48 hours. And he makes two points. One is that by attempting to pass this bill, Congress is moving from passing the laws to enacting the laws. And that is the role of the executive branch. And it's widely expected that President Obama, through the State Department, will approve the Keystone XL pipeline sometime this summer, late on a Friday afternoon. That's my guess. But Grayson notes that Congress does not have the power, even if it passes a bill, to enforce its laws or to enact them. He also points out that the bill is an earmark. Remember earmarks when members of Congress could say, oh, you know, I'm going to give $100,000 to build a bridge in my district? And after a lot of chest thumping and brow beating, the Republicans said, we're not going to do earmarks anymore. Well, Grayson points out that not only is the Keystone XL deal an earmark because it appropriates money to a specific entity, but it's an earmark to a foreign corporation, the Canadian company TransCanada that owns the pipeline. So showtime here, I got word from the congressman's office that there is a video. I don't know if it's at C-SPAN or where. I'll try to find it and mention it tomorrow. But a video of an exchange on the floor between Congressman Grayson and the chair pro tem. It's not Boehner himself, but somebody who is sitting with the gavel there in the House at the time when Grayson spoke. And speaking of pipelines and the energy industry, our colleague Steve Horn is back at it at DSmog Blog. Last week I reported to you that the Interior Department has published its proposed rulemaking for the letting of leases in public lands to permit oil and gas exploration using hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. And what Horn reports today is that that posting, that statement, it's this draft proposal from the Interior Department, was largely written by our good friends at ALEC, the right-wing American Legislative Exchange Council. And in turn, their model bill was originally written by goons at ExxonMobil. And I can't resist this. Horn has the best description I've ever seen of ALEC. It is a 98% corporate-funded bill, mill, and dating service that brings predominantly Republican state legislators and corporate lobbyists together at meetings to craft and vote on model bills behind closed doors. Many of these bills end up snaking their way into state houses and become law in what Bill Moyers referred to as the United States of ALEC. The Bureau of Land Management will utilize an iteration of ALEC's Disclosure of Hydraulic Fracturing Fluid Composition Act, a bill the New York Times revealed was written by ExxonMobil, for chemical fluid disclosure of fracking on public lands. He points out that this whole process is a boondoggle to begin with. The Obama administration allowed industry to have an outsized role in setting the regulations that it must live under, and that they set up a program called Frack Focus, which is a kind of greenwashing effort to silence critics of fracking by saying, oh, it's also transparent. But Frack Focus allows companies to claim an exemption to disclosure of the chemical cocktail that they pump into the ground, citing that they are trade secrets. And one representative from Texas said it allows truck-sized loopholes in chemical disclosure. And Horn quotes Bloomberg, energy companies failed to list more than 2 out of every 5 fracked wells in 8 U.S. states from April 2011 through the end of last year. The gaps reveal shortcomings in the voluntary approach to transparency on the site. That's Frack Focus, which has received funding from oil and gas trade groups and $1.5 million from the U.S. Department of Energy. I will link to Steve Horn's detailed article in the show file at peterbcollins.com. This morning, as I was perusing my daily news sources, I dropped into Roger Schuler's legalschnauzer.blogspot.com and found out that last week there was testimony before the House Judiciary Committee regarding presidential pardons and just how stingy Barack Obama is with his pardon and commutation powers. And Roger Schuler cited a San Francisco columnist who is the token conservative at the Chronicle newspaper, a woman I've known for more than 20 years, and we don't agree on a lot of things. Deborah J. Saunders is often, in my view, a knee-jerk conservative. But I give her credit because for a long time, even during the Bush administration, she has been advocating for presidential pardon for a man named Clarence Aaron, who was convicted under the draconian crack cocaine law that has since been suspended. And I have great respect for Ms. Saunders on her sense of clemency and presidential power. So I was pleasantly surprised when I saw her for the first time in my reading of her columns reference the case of Don Siegelman, the former Democratic governor of Alabama, who is still in federal prison in Louisiana. And while Saunders sidesteps how Don Siegelman got there, railroaded into prison by Karl Rove and corrupt Republicans in the grand old state of Alabama, she does correctly note that more than 113 former state attorneys general from both parties have called for either relief from the courts or by the president for Don Siegelman. And when Attorney General Eric Holder appeared before the House Judiciary Committee last week, Congressman Steve Cohen, Democrat of Tennessee, brought up the pardon power and urged Holder to champion a presidential pardon for Siegelman. Holder responded that his office could not consider clemency while Siegelman has a pending appeal. Cohen then asked about an inspector general report that found that pardon attorney... Well, before I get to that, to my knowledge, Don Siegelman is preparing an appeal. But he doesn't currently have one on file, and his previous appeals have been exhausted. So I think that Holder is either intentionally obfuscating or simply misinformed when he used that dodge to say, well, you know, I got to wait for the appeals to run their course. So Cohen then asked about an inspector general report that found that the pardon attorney, Ronald Rogers, a Bush holdover, withheld information that could have led to the release of Clarence Aaron. Holder answered that corrective measures have been put in place so that kind of mistake would not happen in the future. Then Cohen says, well, it seems to me a corrective measure would be to replace Rogers. And Saunders editorializes, because she's allowed to, no lie. Usually, attorneys general don't like subordinates withholding vital information from a president. And so we need to keep the pressure on here. I am glad to hear that Steve Cohen spoke up about the Siegelman case. There's been way too much silence in Washington, D.C. And I don't want to see Don Siegelman languish in federal prison for the rest of what is at least a five-year run on his total sentence. We champion the cause of whistleblowers, and maybe you've heard our latest in-depth interview with kind of a dueling whistleblower. Some rifts in the whistleblower community revealed in our latest study of a whistleblower case, that of Robert McLean. Today we'll give the federal whistleblowers the day off as we focus on whistleblowers in the Roman Catholic Church. And I am glad to see that about a dozen priests and nuns have formed a group called Catholic Whistleblowers. They began organizing 9 months ago without the knowledge of the bishops or cardinals, and they plan to make their campaign public this week. Most in the steering group of 12 have blown the whistle on abusers in the past. Three are canon lawyers, that's church lawyers, who once handled abuse cases on behalf of the church. Four of the 12 say they were sexually abused as children. They want to support victims, fellow whistleblowers, change church policies. The group has sent a letter to new Pope Francis asking him to take several significant steps to heal victims and restore the church's credibility. Importantly, to revoke all oaths of secrecy, open the files on abuse cases, remove from office any bishops who obstructed justice. Wow, that could go all the way to Rome. And create an international forum for dialogue between survivors and church leaders. And this group now estimates that the number of criminal priests, they call them abusive clergy, I call them criminal priests, is now estimated to exceed 6,275. These are sex criminals. Just like we've talked about in the U.S. military, they use the authority that they have. In this case, it's a robe and a Roman collar. In the other case, it's a uniform and a rank. To have their way with people under their power. It is simply unacceptable in any kind of civilized world to allow people simply to put on a uniform, say that they work for God, and then let them get away with sex crimes that any other person would be jailed for a long time for. And here's an example right now of somebody who abused that authority under color of law. Norman Welsh, or Welsh, I don't know how to pronounce the guy's name, but he was exposed a couple of years ago as the cop who was staging dirty DUIs in East Bay bedroom communities of the San Francisco Bay Area. He was the commander of an elite anti-drug task force in the East Bay. Yesterday, he was sentenced to 14 years in prison. And he deserves every minute of it. Because he not only abused his status as a law enforcement officer running an anti-drug task force, but he colluded with a private detective to set up males who were involved in messy divorce proceedings with a DUI. They would use pretty women as decoys, send them into a bar where the subject or suspect, the target, was. They'd get him drunk, and as he left the bar, the private detective would call his buddy the cop. They'd send a patrol car, pick the guy up, and it made serious problems for them in their divorce case when they had to confront a DUI at the same time. Not only that, this guy Welsh stole $30,000 worth of drugs from evidence lockers. He was running a massage parlor prostitution front in an East Bay community. And I just learned that one of his arguments is that he's been unfairly singled out because of his former profession. That's the reason he deserves a lengthy sentence. More than any just, you know, garden variety street criminal. And at the sentencing, we hear for the first time that Welsh, who in some cases would set up a date with a prostitute, go to a hotel, and then rob them of cash and cell phones. He said he did that because the private detective, Butler, had videotaped Wielsch's sexual encounter with two women and threatened to send the tape to the guy's wife. So we had an alleged blackmail scheme between these two co-defendants, and Butler, by the way, got 8 years in the slammer. And finally today, Guatemala's top court has annulled the conviction, the genocide conviction of former dictator Efrain Rios Montt. They ordered that his trial be restarted to solve several appeal issues. This comes 10 days after he was found guilty and sentenced to 80 years in prison. And, of course, Ronald Reagan and many of his cronies should be there with him. And now I want to end the show today with a little musical tribute to Ray Manzarek of The Doors. We'll get to some of the big hits by The Doors in a moment. But one of my real treasured items in the Peter B. Collins tax-deductible music archives is this solo CD, a concept album that was produced by Ray Manzarek in the late 1970s. It's called The Golden Scarab, a rhythm myth. And it is a theme piece, kind of art rock. And he exposes himself as a true intellectual in some of his lyrical citations. And it's also got some really cool licks on various keyboards. The real talent of Ray Manzarek.
I'm in Hotep. Akhenaten. Nefertiti. Tutankhamun. All of life is sunlight. Osiris is the night. Aten of the daylight. Bring you golden life. Across the sun ball, golden scarab light. Golden and glowing and spinning and shining and beaming sublimely, you first light of morning. Blazing light high in the sky of your noontime. Red, warm, and soft light as nightfall is soon time. You shine the mind, no fear, no time. The dream, the sun.
That's Ray Manzarek. It's called The Golden Scarab, and it's one of two solo records that he released in the mid to late 1970s. The other was called, It's Only Rock and Roll and It's Out of Control, or something like that. And I looked online at both iTunes and at Ardio, which is the music service I use, and neither one of them had these solo outings. If you can find them in your favorite vintage CD or record shop, pick them up. They're both very interesting musical collections. After Jim Morrison died, The Doors tried to go on as a trio. And Ray Manzarek, with that big bass voice, stepped up to the microphone. And this is a song that I have always loved with Ray up front. It's called Ships with Sails. And maybe I like it because I'm a sailor.
Well, you asked how much I love you. Why do ships with sails love the wind? And will I be thinking of you? Will I ever pass this way again? I'll be returning someday. Until then, please don't ask me my direction. Let my tracks be buried in the sea. 'Cause to wander's my infection. Till the four winds bring you back to me. Don't count your memories. Think of me as just a dream. Just like this melody I sing.
Ships with Sails, that one's called. I don't need to identify this one. And just the keyboard noodling at the very beginning of this song and in the musical center break evokes Ray Manzarek.
I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
Also, this one, Break On Through, it's just another example of how the keyboard was so important to the sound of the Doors.
You know, the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, break on through to the other side, yeah.
The Doors had some really interesting offbeat songs. And this is one that I've always dug. It's called Texas Radio and the Big Beat.
I want to tell you about Texas Radio and the Big Beat.
Thanks, Jim.
Comes out of the Virginia swamps, cool and slow with plenty of precision. The backbeat narrow and hard to master. Some call it heavenly in its brilliance. Others mean and rueful of the Western dream. I love the friends I have gathered together in this thin raft. We have constructed pyramids in honor of our escaping. This is the land where the Pharaoh died.
There's some strains of similarity between what Jim Morrison just referred to and the themes of Ray Manzarek's solo, the Golden Scarab. This is a remix of a song that you'll recognize right now. Again, a keyboard tour de force from Ray Manzarek on L.A. Woman. Oh, I did a little Dynamite about an hour ago. And let's not forget John Densmore and Robbie Krieger with a great rhythm section that made the Doors such a powerful, powerful sound. And my big brother Tom brought home Strange Days when I was preteen. Played that baby over and over and over again.
Took a look around, they went with a wind blow. With a little girl in a Hollywood bungalow. Are you a lucky little?
And here's perhaps my all-time favorite Doors song.
Well, I've been down so goddamn long that it looks like up to me.
And I'm really torn because I'd like to play When the Music's Over. But I think the fitting way to say goodbye to Ray Manzarek is to play The End. This is The End, my friend. Thanks for all the great music, Ray Manzarek.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend. The end of our elaborate plans. The end of everything that stands. The end. No safety or surprise, the end. I'll never look into your eyes again. Can you picture what will be? So stranger's hand in a desperate land. Lost in a romance, wilderness of pain, and all the children are insane. All the children are insane. Thank you.
Cheer.